Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
And you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight.
Each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's get together. Let's get to the issues, the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Said don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Todd Patkin with us. He is the co-author. Let me make an adjustment here. He's the co-author of Finding Happiness, One Man's Quest to Beat Depression and Anxiety, and Finally Let the Sun Shine In. He grew up in Needham, Massachusetts. After graduating from Tufts University, he joined the family business and spent the next 18 years helping to grow it to new heights. After it was purchased in advance by Advance Auto Parts in 2005, he was free to focus on his main passions, philanthropy and giving back to the community, spending time with family and friends and helping more people learn how to love. Todd, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Hi, Todd, do we have you?
Yes, do you hear me, Michael? Michael?
Yeah, oh, yes, hi, Todd.
I'm sorry, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you fine now. That way it works really well. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you great.
Wonderful. Okay, by the way, thank you for being here. Let's start the show with this. There's something called separation anxiety. There are many, many people who go through it, and it's really more prevalent than most people think. But in addition to that, most people don't even know that they have it, and there's problems because of it. So let's go all the way back and say, what was it about separation anxiety that caught you up to actually write about this and put this information to pen?
Well, you know, my book is really about helping people to change the way they view their lives and to go from anxiety and depression to happiness. And I wrote a memoir and a self-help book. And during the story of my life, when I was 10 years old, I was sent to overnight camp for the first time. And I really had a harrowing experience. 72 hours into it, I was so distraught that I actually tried to drink paint to get myself sent home, not necessarily to get myself killed, but I was able to get sent home. But it's really haunted me ever since then. And I think it's important. People don't often realize that traumatic things in our childhood can affect us even when we're older.
Oh, no question about it. And some of the talking points where I have your press release in front of me, because when you deal with separation anxiety, you know, somebody can suffer nightmares, they can manifest physical symptoms, they can get stomach aches, they can have panic attacks, and the list goes on, and they cling to you, especially in an age-appropriate way. What causes this? What is that first time that it happens? Would it be something like that happened to you, or is this something that grows over a period of time?
You know, I don't really know. I know with me, I guess to coin a funny phrase, I was a real mama's boy. So even when my mother would leave me when I was at school, when I was very younger, she'd go out on date nights with my father. It was very difficult for me. But you'd be surprised how many adults I speak to who say, you know, it's the damnedest thing. I never had issues with anxiety and separation, not even in college. And then all of a sudden, I started having some issues, when I would have to travel on business trips. So I don't know if we really know, you know, why all of a sudden it fosters itself. I do know that over 25% of college students have at least one severe episode of separation anxiety and homesickness, and that's why I think parents need to give some more thought to simply sending, little Jimmy or little Jennifer away at age 9, because all the neighbors do it in our culture. If it's that difficult to do it at age 18, we really need to give more thought to the possible damage we're doing to our kids at age 9 or age 10.
Okay, but prepping them for this, and in addition to that, I think something like this, I've said it a few times over the year with different subject matters that you've come up, but I really believe, Todd, that when you look at it, if something like this could be taught as early as high school, the potential of what could happen, to look out for it before it happens so you can anticipate it ahead of time. Because from what I'm hearing you say, it's not genetic, it's not a family thing. It's something that can happen immediately, a fear of something, a separation where you can't get back home, that would cause this, and you may not recognize it now, but 20 years later, you're going through all this suffering, and you have no idea why, and you haven't put the two together.
Right. Well, my co-author, Dr. Howard Rankin, said the statistic is 1 in 25 children suffer from severe separation anxiety, so it's actually a term. And so I guess if your children are showing, tremendous fright, when you're leaving, it's a good idea to seek a professional and at least, find out some counsel if they think that your child is more prone to separation anxiety, and certainly that would help them going forward.
So it's the fear of being, and stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician, Todd, but it's the fear of being alone, it's the fear of being left, the inability to stand up on your own, I'll exaggerate it, the inability to stand up on your own. And you need that something there, that the family there, the structure there, because without them, you can't.
Yeah, and in addition to that, it's not just the fear of being alone. It's the fear of not being with perhaps a specific individual, whether it's your mother or your father, that you've become very, attached to. I know that when parents are having difficulty and the kids think they might be getting divorced, for example, my cousin said that he never had separation anxiety at overnight camp until the summer that he thought that, his parents were considering getting divorced, and he felt, at least when he was home, he could keep an eye on the situation, but when he went to camp, perhaps he'd come back and find out that they had already been separated. So, I think it's more than just being alone. It's, many times kids think that they're kind of controlling the environment, back home, making sure that nothing changes.
But that can also work, from what I'm hearing you say, that can also work both ways. The separation anxiety where the parents got it as opposed to the child.
It's very important. Most parents will have a very difficult time the first time their child goes away, whether it's even to college or it's to camp. And it's very important that if your child's going to go to camp that you don't, mention to them, boy, I don't know if I can make it through this summer myself, because that just puts more pressure on them, Michael.
I remember, and I'm going to go back to, there was a time I went to camp. There was certain times I did things where I was away from home, and I didn't have the separation anxiety, but one of the things that you just mentioned would have been very powerful. I wonder how many parents sit down with their kids and say, okay, you're going to go to camp. This may be your first time. What are your feelings about it? And I don't mean to get all emotional and counselor-type mushy, okay? But just that flat, what do you think? What do you feel like, what's going to happen when you get there? Are you going to be afraid? Do you think that you're going to be concerned because mom and dad aren't going to be there? And just let the kid talk. And I imagine you could clean up a lot of it before it even happened.
Yeah, I think a lot of parents, again, if they see that in several communities up in the Boston area, it's just the thing to do. At age 10, you send your kids to overnight camp. And kids are different. Some kids are ready and some kids aren't. So I believe that you should never send your kids away from you for an extended period of time unless they want to go. And so absolutely speak to them. And if they want to go, by all means. But if they don't want to go, you're setting yourself up for a very difficult situation, because all of a sudden, a week from now or 2 days from now, they call you and they beg you to come home and they tell you that they're, going to do something dramatic. And if you take them home, trust me, it will affect them the rest of their lives. It's affected me. I mean, I certainly feel less than, because I couldn't stick it out. But if you leave them up there, hopefully it will work out, and usually they fight through it. But if it doesn't, you know, something more dramatic could happen. So it's very difficult. I certainly think it's worth waiting the extra year.
Oh, sure. By the way, no question about it. Todd, the other, I want to talk about your co-author, Dr. Howard Rankin. He's a psychologist, but he's also the president of the American Brain Association. I guess my question there really is, does neuroscience play a role in separation anxiety?
Well, I mean, in terms of our entire book and the premise of my book, if you ask me what most people would learn from the book, it's that throughout our younger years, we're being programmed unintentionally. Our parents don't mean to do it, but they teach us how to view the world. And most of us view the world today, in my opinion, in very destructive ways. It's almost like we're running the wrong program. We're running a program that says be unhappy and be anxious. And my book helps you to switch to the program to be less anxious and be happy. And Howard believes that all of these things are about 50% genetics and 50% you're learning from age 1 to 4. So I think he would say the same thing. I know that everyone in my family, for the most part, had separation anxiety.
Okay, all right. So realistically, then when you know what you have, okay, when you know what you have, how do you fix it? And I know that's a very simple question with a very complex answer. But what's the first step? Obviously, the first step is to recognize that you have something. But from
not to make something more general, but so much of it, I think, is parental training. I mean, you're talking about young kids and parents and deciding, you know, when something is more serious and how to go about handling it. And I think it would be helpful if parents had more training or more classes on how to handle children. But it's tough. You know, my brother toughed it out, and my sister and I really weren't able to tough out camp. So I really don't. I don't have an answer for you other than I think we need more education and perhaps more books like I wrote for parents.
And that's an interesting point, because being a parent doesn't necessarily mean you know how to parent. What goes on, go back a couple
hundred
years.
Do any of us know how to parent?
Yeah, well, those parents have learned from their parents who have learned from their parents who have learned from their parents. And as the culture changes, There are things that are inherent in that culture, psychological things that are inherent in that culture that are going to happen. And if parents don't know about this, which they're not going to automatically know, they've got to be taught, then it can run rampant in the family.
This is the premise of my book, is that we all learn from our parents who learn from their parents who learn from their parents. And 3 generations ago, it was, we're immigrants, we work 7 days a week, and it's all about being perfect and looking at everything that we do wrong so we can do better and get ahead so our great-grandkids don't have to work and be so stressed out. And here we are. We don't have to work as hard. We don't have to pick at all of our faults. But we continue to pick at our faults, making ourselves feel bad about ourselves, because that's the way that our parents were trained by our grandparents, who essentially needed to do that in order to move up the company ladder. So absolutely, you know, somehow we need to realize we're at a different time. Kids today are watching, you know, crazy shows on television. They're, you know, they've got the internet. They've got less communication with, you know, kids out in the playground. Everything's very different today.
Absolutely.
I certainly think that it's very difficult to be a parent.
No, by the way, there is no question. In addition to that, if you go back a number of years, parents had control over what happened in the house. Now the parents don't have all of that control. You got a different kid, and you got a different relationship between the parent and the child today. And you've got more people, quote unquote, living in the family. You've got the school system. You've got child welfare, and this list can go on. So the parent is having a problem because they cannot control the education of that child the way that they did at one time. And then what happens? We run into something like this. Todd, I'm glad you've got this information out. Let me ask you this. We're starting to run short of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, I'd love to offer my website, www.toddpatkin.com. www.toddpatkin.com. You'll see my book trailer. I've got it, 12 weeks to learning how to live a happier life. You can spend 5 minutes a week with me for 12 weeks and change your life. And then, of course, the book is available on Amazon. And believe it or not, we blew out of the first 1,000 copies in less than 2 weeks. But wow. It says it's on back order, but I just shipped them and they received it today. So please ignore the fact that it says back order. If you order it today or tomorrow, you'll have it within 10 days.
Wonderful. Hey, Todd, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated it, and I think it's a great subject you've got.
Thank you so much, Michael Ray.
Thank you. Good night.
To know there, so tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS radio network, if I have a voice.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone.
Our guest, Dr. Norman Rosenthal, M.D., he is the author of Transcendence, Healing, and Transformation Through Transcendental Meditation. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown Medical School and has maintained a private practice in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area for nearly 30 years now. He's conducted research at the National Institute of Mental Health as a research fellow, researcher, and senior researcher for over 20 years. And let us say, Norman, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And thank you so much for being here. Transcendence, we're talking about transcendental meditation. Let's lay a base of what, a practical base of what transcendental meditation is, and then we can work from there.
It's a simple technique that involves sitting down twice a day for 20 minutes, closing your eyes, making yourself comfortable, and then working with a mantra, or shall I say just thinking a mantra, that has been given to you by a teacher, and shown, you're shown kind of how to use that mantra in a way that has the desired effect, which we can talk about in a moment. So those are the elements that are key to the practice.
Okay, that's the dynamic, but the end result, and what I understand, stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician, but when we're dealing with transcendental meditation, we're talking about somebody gaining the ability to become mindful for that moment that they're doing it, or moments that they're doing it, they're fully and totally concentrated. They've got homeostasis. They've got balance, which normally through the day we don't have that. We have stress. We have other factors that cause us to be healthy, to be sick, to be whatever the case may be. But being able to center for whatever time that you can allows you to become mindful and to let the body and all the mechanisms of the body do what they're supposed to do.
You know, I would use slightly different words, and it's not really just semantic. Rather than saying mindful, I would say it helps you transcend. Why do I say that as a difference? Because there is a whole branch of meditation called mindfulness, whereby you really focus on what's going on in the moment, whether it's your breathing or your thoughts or whatever. This is very different. The mantra comes in a very automatic way once you get the hang of it. And what that does, it's almost like a diving bell that takes you down into a different state of consciousness, which is called transcendence, which is why I called the book Transcendence. And what that state does is it allows you to access a very joyful and pleasurable state within the self. At the same time, it lets all the systems of the body relax. Blood pressure drops, breathing slows down, and the effects of these 20 minutes twice a day carry on through the rest of the day, influencing all your feelings and your physiological systems.
But moving through this, and this is a question now, moving through this, we go through life with mechanisms. We go through life with chemicals that are triggered based on an emotion, based on an experience, etc. And to get to this particular place that you're talking about, at that stage, when you talk about joyfulness, etc., at that stage, aren't we in a position whereby if the body is calm, those defense mechanisms aren't there, and you're not going through any kind of a pressure. So you go beyond that quote-unquote fight-or-flight mechanism.
Definitely. That is absolutely right. The fight-or-flight mechanisms are stilled. They're settled down. And these, of course, in our modern world, are mechanisms that grind on relentlessly sometimes. And we see it in people who are working too hard or people who are under all kinds of different pressures. It's so common. And then we also see it in special groups like veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder and other people. But you don't have to look to special groups. Everybody or many, many people are under stress. If I talk to an audience and I say, put up your hands, who's under stress on a daily basis? Hardly a hand doesn't go up because we're all feeling it lots of the time, and it really is a fantastic stress relief mechanism for settling this down.
Now, let's take it even to a more simpler basis. You're standing in the house. Your wife says to you, did you take the garbage out? Is it a question or is it an accusation? If you take it as
right.
a question, there's no mechanism. If you take it as an accusation, the entire mechanism kicks up and you've got stress going. We automatically defend and it's unconscious and we're not even aware of it, Norman.
That's so true. I mean, you could think, she's always bugging me. Nothing I ever do is enough. So you could escalate it very easily. Or you could say, you know, she wants to know if I took the garbage out. And,
yes.
you know, be very calm about it. Well, what I find with people, once they start to do transcendental meditation, they're much more likely to do the second one. I use as a common example being cut off in traffic. Quite an irritating thing, and I don't think anybody likes being cut off in traffic. But, you know, I've seen people swearing at the other driver and making gestures and whatever, and you can imagine that's not very good for one's nervous system. You know, somebody who's meditating is much more likely to say, you know, maybe that person has a problem, but why should I let it become my problem?
And by the way, what we're really dealing with in most people today, with the stress that is going on with the economy, the downturn, the lack of jobs, and this list goes on, and the apathetic condition that we've gotten ourselves into because of not taking a stand of what's going on politically, you look at all of these factors and you throw them into the mix, no wonder somebody is stressful. But at the same time, if you use a process like you're talking about, it allows you to calm down, allows you to get it back together again, and not have to jump at something. You can sit back, take it in, and then you have, quote unquote, you have choice of how you're going to feel about it.
Right, it's true.
Yeah.
And I do want to say, you know, I'm a scientist, but I'm also a meditator. I was at the National Institute of Health for 20 years. And I actually did a lot of original work myself. I described the syndrome called seasonal affective disorder, and I developed the treatment of light therapy. That was my original work. And I simply say it by way of saying, you know, I'm not somebody who's going to jump on every fad that comes along.
Sure.
I examined this area, and I decided that this is really something worth telling people about. I know it personally because I would never recommend anything that I didn't, you know, like this, that I didn't personally try and find actually that was very transformative in my own life and in my patients' lives. But I've examined the research data, and there really are some extraordinary facts that are worth just knowing about. For example, that it reduces blood pressure, it reduces cardiovascular disease, and now in two studies, it actually prolongs life, which is pretty unbelievable when you think about it.
No, absolutely. Well, I can imagine if the stress is eliminated, it allows your immune system to work. Most of us have a lot of stress, and because of that stress, it affects the immune system, and we know what can happen there. So if you're calming down, if you're centered, it allows the immune system to kick in and effectively do the job. And by the way, the SAD that you were just talking about, I spent 24 years in Fairbanks, Alaska, where we had dark. What was it, 7-8 months out of the year? So I actually saw cases of that.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
I said that with the SAD, I said I lived in Fairbanks, Alaska, the interior, for about 23, 24 years. So I actually saw cases of the problem with not getting enough sunlight and not enough light.
Yes, it can really be quite serious. So, you know, I'm glad you've seen it in your own life.
Now, by the way, when we talk about meditation, how does one start? You know, and one of the things when I say how does one start, when the majority of people think of meditation, they're thinking of you're sitting 3 feet off the ground and you're meditating and you hear what I'm saying. And that's not really what it is. It's a science. How do you get somebody to really look at it in the light that it really is as opposed to what it's been, the mask that it's worn?
Right. Well, this particular brand of meditation, transcendental meditation, it's a little bit like yoga or karate. You have to go and find a guide, a teacher, somebody who is credentialed to teach it, because it is like one of those skills that even though once you get the hang of it, it's pretty simple. Somebody needs to teach you. You can't get, you know, $10 book and then learn it out of the book like you couldn't do with golf or tennis or any of these, you know, evolved skills. So you find a good teacher. You can do that. My book lists resources. By all means, you can check out the TM organization or the David Lynch Foundation or my website, which is normanrosenthal.com. All of these will lead you to available resources. But the reason that I wrote the book is that, you know, 20 minutes twice a day, in a modern life, that's a lot to ask of somebody. And I know for myself that before I would devote that amount of time, I would need to be really and truly persuaded that it was absolutely worth it. And that's what my book lays out. It lays out a rationale for why somebody would really benefit and enjoy that time. Because, you know, oftentimes, Wordsworth many years ago said, the world is too much with us. And if it was true then, heavens, is it true now with the internet and all the plugins that we have to the communication networks? And so this is an opportunity to have some quiet time in the course of the day to practice a technique that's going to restore and regenerate you. And you know, like I have a day of patience, an afternoon of patience. I sit down 20 minutes later. It's as though your windshield has been wiped clean and the world looks fresh and clear again. It's quite extraordinary, actually.
I think we're getting to a point whereby we're realizing more and more that the brain is an electrochemical factory, and the chemicals in and of themselves are going to determine and dictate how you are going to be through the day and how you're going to be through your life, physically, emotionally, intellectually, you name it, it's going to be caused by some kind of a chemical. What I'm hearing you say is when you calm down, you put everything in order and they're doing what they're supposed to do, and you're not triggering those that are going to, quote unquote, protect you and cause stress and cause problems in your life. It's controlling.
Absolutely. You know, there's much talk about a, quote, happiness checkpoint. The idea that all of us have got our level of happiness and that no matter what we do, that's we're going to come back to that point. I don't believe that. I believe we can raise whatever biology has given us. We can make the most of it. And one way to do it is to conserve our chemicals. So I think that you're absolutely right. It is a very complicated chemical, electrical, to call it a machine almost doesn't do it justice because it's such an intricate work of art. But I think we can boost those processes and feel better. Also, I want to mention to you that although you're calm, you're not calm like a zombie. You know, you're calm and energized at the same time. It's a wonderful mix of being, not being anxious, but being very alert and alive. It's a lovely combination that goes into transcendence, which incidentally, once you are meditating regularly, spills over into the everyday life and gives you the enjoyment and the benefit throughout the day.
And by the way, I think that when we talk about the chemicals, dopamine, that's the chemical that fuels the brain's pleasure center. And a smile will release the dopamine or endorphins. And laughter, they say, is the best medicine. What actually happens is when your brain releases that, it's a dopamine squirt. And you feel better, you calm down. And it's very interesting. If somebody were angry, if you just took the moment and smiled, forced yourself to laugh, that's actually controlling the chemistry that goes through your brain that affects your emotions and your body. So once you've got a handle on it, and I really believe to get a handle on it, you've got to do what you're talking about, the transcendence, to get into that space whereby you know what you're doing, you can control the way the mechanisms of your body work, and you can control the way you feel.
Well, you've just said it better than I could. I agree with absolutely everything you say.
And then, by the way, but it's a so, and I think that's really what it boils down to be. You can't control. You can't control somebody from walking up and slapping you in the face, quote unquote. But you can control the way you feel about it and your response and your reactions to it. And I think that's really at base of what we're talking about here today.
Yes, yes. And you know, when you find something that's really wonderful, like, I mean, on the simplest level, when you find a restaurant that you just think is marvelous, you want to tell everybody about that restaurant. You want all your friends to go and enjoy it. And that's sort of how I felt with discovering the technique. You know, you can discover things in many ways. And when I say discovered it, I discovered it for myself. Obviously, it had been discovered many years ago, but when I stumbled across it, and I describe in the book how I stumbled across it, and when I felt the personal benefits and saw the benefits in my patients, that then inspired me with a kind of passion that said, let me explain it to other people. Now, you know, when you're passionately trying to encourage other people to do something, it's very common for people to feel, wait a sec, what's this guy selling me, you know? It's very, we're a skeptical culture, and we should be, because there are lots of people selling us something all the time. So we should be skeptical. But what I found is that when you've got a book that you can take into the privacy of your own space, read it in your own time, read it however you want to do it, that's when you have the chance to really think about something and determine, is this interesting? Is this right for me? That's what I'm so happy to be able to present with this particular book.
Norman, we're just about out of time. And by the way, the book in and of itself, I've got the book in my hand, and it's forwarded by Dr. Oz, quote unquote. Now, is there a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Absolutely. You can find me on normanrosenthal.com, and it's very simple to order the book through that website.
Wonderful.
And it's just my name, normanrosenthal.com. By all means, if your listeners would like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Dr. Norman, D-O-C-T-O-R, Norman. Join me over there. I'm constantly updating people with the new developments and new events and exciting things that are going on. There's a kind of a buzz out there, and I'm just so happy to be a part of it because it's a buzz that's spreading positive, good things to make people feel healthier and happier.
Norm, thank you so much for being with us. I've appreciated your time. Good work, and the book is great. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a joy. Take care. Bye-bye.
Good night.
When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You were listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Russell Skull with us, corporate executive chef from Fleming's Steak Prime House. I got it back, which Prime's, she even hit me when I said that. Prime Steakhouse and Wine Bar. Russell, hi. Welcome to the show.
Oh, welcome. You know what? I mix it up sometimes too, so.
By the way, backwards is great. Then it gives me the entire show to get it right. By the way,
there
corporate
you go.
Corporate
executive chef. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Because, you know, I can go through your bio, which I was going to go through, but the key here is we are really dealing with something that is a special gift for fathers on Father's Day. You take them for the greatest meal that they've ever had, and all of a sudden you got a dad who appreciates you, because I'm looking at the menu now, and we are talking about filet mignon, New York strip sirloin, ribeye steak, porterhouse steaks, and what more could you ask for a gift on Father's Day for a father?
Oh, it's pretty good, I tell you, but you have to throw that prime rib in there.
Oh,
that's
by the way,
phenomenal
absolutely.
Deal, and I tell you, the father, it's been a big hit every year since we've had it on.
Now, let me ask you this. When we talk about steaks, you know, you can go to a place and order a steak, but a steak just isn't a steak, is it?
No, it's not. Obviously, when you said Prime Steakhouse, Prime connotates the best of the beef out there. About 2% of all beef available.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there?
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And Rio just be only names to you and me.
Dr. Deborah Davis with us. She's the author of Disconnect, The Truth About Cell Phone Radiation, What the Industry Has Done to Hide It, and How to Protect Your Family. She's a designated National Book Award finalist for When Smoke Run Like Water, Basic Books, and Deborah Davis founded the Environmental Health Trust in 2007 in Teton County, Wyoming, to provide basic research and education about environmental health hazards and promote constructive policies locally, nationally, and internationally. Deborah, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we hear so much about cell phones today and radiation and its tie-in to brain cancer. How much of that should we listen to? Is there really validity behind those statements?
Well, you have to understand what about brain cancer. It can take 40 years to develop in the human population after exposure takes place. So we know that from the studies of the survivors of the atom bomb that fell at the end of World War II, where there was no increase in brain cancer at all in the general population until four decades after the bombs dropped. So we don't want to wait for that kind of proof in the human population. With the World Health Organization just last month had a group of distinguished experts from around the world exhaustively review evidence, experimental studies as well as human studies, and that group of the World Health Organization concluded that cell phone radiation is a, quote, possible cause of cancer. Now, you have to understand, that category of possible cause of cancer is a category that includes engine exhausts and pesticides. So it's not a designation that's entered into lightly. And I think the real challenge for us in the modern era is recognizing the value that cell phones have in our lives. How do we get to be smarter about how we use them? And the experts
let me jump in for a minute. Wait, I want to make sure that we all get this because it's an extremely important issue to address. Do you know anybody without a cell phone? And probably the answer is going to be no. I mean, you know, from 6 years old up. So the key is this. The operative word, number one, is possible. So we know that they're not saying this is exactly what it is. But let's say that they did say that we have proof. It's scientifically proven, tried, true, and tested that there is a problem with this. My question is the manufacturers of cell phones, since they know that the possibility, the potential of this kind of a problem is there anything that they can do to block it, to be able to do something whereby that radiation is not going to go from that phone into your head?
You know, that's a really good question, and I'm not a phone designer, nor am I an electrical engineer. But here's what I can tell you. Distance is your friend. So keeping a phone just at your arm's length, not across the room, just holding it in your hand, reduces your radiation exposure by more than 10,000-fold. So that's a simple solution in the meantime. Yes, you're absolutely right. There have to be ways to design phones and devices around them that will make us get less exposure. But the simplest thing to do is to use an earpiece and not keep the phone directly on your body. Any earpiece will substantially reduce radiation.
Like a Bluetooth.
A Bluetooth, which is a wireless headset, will reduce it. But I'm concerned when people use Bluetooth and they keep the phone in their pocket, and phones are never tested in pockets, because if they were, they would not pass the standards that are used today. And on our website at environmentalhealthtrust.org, you can click on cell phone safety, and you'll see the fine print warnings that come with the BlackBerry, with the Apple iPhone 4, which says, do not keep them in your pocket. And in the case of the BlackBerry, it says, avoid direct exposure to the abdomen of pregnant women or teenagers. Now, very few people read that fine print warning, but that's what manufacturers have done. They put fine print warnings to tell people not to keep phones directly in their pockets or on their bodies.
Okay, but if I was to use a Bluetooth, I have a BlackBerry, and if I have the BlackBerry in a case on my belt, is that safe?
Well, you know, safety is a relative thing. If you want to be safe, live in a bubble. It's safer, but it's really not as safe as if you have that phone off your body and on the desk in front of you. You can use a phone in a clip, but I'm very concerned about people keeping phones in clips and having them on all day long, because phones are constantly searching for signals from the towers. And particularly when the signal is weak on a phone, then the phone needs to use more energy to reach that tower and will, as a consequence, put more radiation into your body when it's trying to reach that tower.
See, I think the biggest concern that I would have as a manufacturer, which I'm not, but we're talking about the ultimate liability. There's a contingent liability between the person who sold the phone and that person who created the phone in the first place. Obviously, there's insurance against it. But if there was verifiable proof that all of this was true, they should be protecting themselves, because once the proof comes to the fore, gets on the table, then you're dealing with a situation that the lawsuits would make most of these companies go broke. So the only concern that I have is, as much as they protect money, and it's about follow the money, as much as they protect money, if they're not doing anything about it, they must feel fairly safe that nobody can come up with something that is tangible that says that this is exactly what will happen if you don't follow the rules here.
Well, actually, I think it's a little more complicated than that, although you make a good point. Because, you see, if brain cancer is the main cancer we're concerned about right now, and there's also cancer of the hearing nerve called acoustic neuroma, and a very rare cancer of the cheek called parotid gland tumor, all of those tumors are very rare. Okay, combined, they may have an incidence of, 10 per 100,000. Okay?
Yeah.
So if that rate doubled or tripled, it would go from 10 to 20 to 30 per 100,000. And frankly, we are dealing with a multi-trillion-dollar global industry, and it would not go broke dealing with lawsuits. And frankly, there will be lawsuits now, because the science, as I indicate in my book, Disconnect, the Truth About Cell Phone Radiation, the science is fairly compelling. And that's why I wrote the book, which was published in 2010, and that's why the World Health Organization International Agency for Research on Cancer just reached its conclusion of putting cell phones in the same category as engine exhausts.
Okay, now, by the way, and just to let you know, I happen to be on your side of the table with this, but there's got to be that middle of the road, something where most people are going to pay attention. Most of us are lazy. Let's face it. We live in a very fast-paced, microwavable world whereby, unless it's done for us, we don't want to take the time to do it. So in essence, when we take a look at the book, we listen to what you have to say, which I think is spot on. There's no question about it. My phone will now go on the desk when I talk. But at the same time, it's got to be user-friendly to be able to do this. Otherwise, there's going to be people out there that will say, yeah, great information, and they're going to use it and end up dying, and by that time, it's too late.
Well, Michael, I want to thank you for your interest and for your taking the time to be informed on this issue, because I think it's because of people like you that we're starting to get a more informed public discussion. I agree with you completely. We need to take a reasonable approach here, and we don't want to terrify people. We want to inform them. I think an educated consumer is really the very foundation of democracy, rests on that. The public can only consent to be governed about that which it is informed. And we have not been given full information here. When I started out writing this book, Disconnect, I owned 3 cell phones. And I was convinced that they had to be safe. And I ended up writing a book because I learned I was wrong. And even though at the time, my colleagues warned me that it would be very dangerous to work in this field because there was such a powerful industry and because most scientists were convinced with a religious fervor that it was a violation of the laws of physics for the weak radiation from a cell phone to have any biological impact. Well, it is true. The weak radiation from cell phones doesn't have a biological impact like X-rays, but it does have a biological impact by disrupting cell membranes, by disrupting resonance, because it's the pulsed nature of the signal from cell phones, the digital nature of the signal that's disruptive, not the strength of it, because it is far too weak to cause direct damage, but the pulsed nature of the signal appears to be disruptive to membranes, whether membranes of the eye, of the brain, of the body. I just came back from Istanbul, where we heard cutting-edge science showing that prenatal exposure to rabbits and rats produced damage to the liver, eyes, and brain of their offspring. And these are controlled studies done by some world-class scientists that the world doesn't know about yet. And that's why it's really important that we inform people. And you're absolutely right. I would welcome your ideas about how we get the message out in a way that will motivate people to act without getting them to turn off.
No, absolutely. And by the way, I happen to think getting somebody terrified is a way to make them start to move. You know, we live in a world whereby we have mixed media messages, and in one side, whatever side, left, right, one side is going to scare you into moving this way. The other side is going to scare you into moving that way. My feeling is, why take a knife to a gunfight? Why don't you fight fire with fire? And if you've got to, if you got to scare somebody into it, then let it be. Because my biggest concern is, I'm listening to what you're saying, you have a child 6-7 years old. Well, fine. Mm-hmm. 10 years old. They carry the cell phone with them because of whatever, and they get to use it. Now they're texting, and their entire world is around that cell phone. All right. So when they got it at 10 years old, that's all well and good. But when they're in the doctor's office at 50, and there's brain cancer, there's something affecting the ears, the cheeks, whatever the case may be, they can't trace it. Where do you go with that?
Yeah. No, I want to see that not happen. I feel like I'm watching an epidemic in slow motion, and that we can prevent that from happening. That's why I've written my book, Disconnect. That's why we started saferphonezone.com with lots of information. We've got open, free resources available, safety pamphlets, a doctor's pamphlet, safety cards. We've had YouTube video contests with schools. Anyone out there listening, we would love to work with the schools. We've got programs for schools starting from elementary school all the way up. And I want to say something about children and cell phones. Children need their parents. You give a child a cell phone, and you're opening them up to a world that you can't control. So parents need to think a little bit more about that. I certainly hope that parents realize children should not sleep with phones. And if you want to give your child a phone because it's going to make you feel better, certainly inform them that the safest way for a child to use a phone, according to the Israeli government, according to the Finnish government, according to the British government, the safest way for a child to use a phone is to text or use a speakerphone or a headset. A child, and frankly the rest of us, should never hold a phone directly next to the brain, because a cell phone is a two-way microwave radio.
Okay, you're speaking, my mind is going here. Let's try something here. Let me frame it in a question and see where we can work with this. How does the immune system recognize the vibration from the cell phone? Because obviously that vibration is going to cause a disconnect. We know that our brain is nothing more than an electrochemical factory. So there's got to be a disconnect to allow it to invade. That's analogous to cancer in and of itself. The cancer is something we develop ourselves. It's in every one of us. The immune system, if there's a proliferation of the cancer, the immune system doesn't recognize it, only because it's not foreign. The immune system's job is to battle foreign antibodies, something foreign in the body. So if that vibration coming from the cell phone is not recognized by the immune system, then that means the immune system thinks that it's part of the normal operation of the body. So somewhere there's got to be the disconnect that causes the problem. If we can get a bridge between the cell and the immune system and find out what the disconnect is, that in and of itself, working from the inside out, could fix the problem.
Wow. First of all, in most studies on the immune system of cell phone radiation have not found a direct impact of cell phones on the immune system. What they have found is an impact on the cell membrane, a weakening of the blood-brain barrier, and production of what are called free radicals. Free radicals are compounds that can actually damage links between chemicals that hold us all together. In addition, cell phones have been found to damage DNA in the nucleus of every living cell of every living thing. And so the question becomes, how can we reduce the amount of direct exposure? And I think the answer there is very simple. Right now, you can start by taking your phone out of your pocket, off your body, keeping it on your desk, and you can occasionally turn it off, and you will survive. But in addition, the manufacturers, I know, are working on making safer phones and safer devices to use phones. And the problem they face, according to friends of mine in the industry, is that while the scientists can already tell you how to make safer phones, and they're starting to do it, they don't want to admit they're safer. Because if they do, then the lawsuits will even be stronger.
Oh, yeah.
On the part of those seeking compensation for brain tumors, because it will be admitting that the cell phone industry has known for some time that they need to make phones that emit less radiation. So it's a real, you know, it's a real dilemma. Unfortunately, I think the parallels with tobacco and asbestos there are some parallels there. Even though cell phones play positive roles in our lives today, the tobacco industry and the asbestos industry worked for years successfully to suppress science. And in my book, Disconnect, I document that that suppression of science has gone on for cell phones. And that suppression, by the way, has ended with the publication of my book and with the declaration of the World Health Organization, International Agency for Research on Cancer, that after reviewing an extensive array of information, cell phone radiation and radio frequency radiation and microwave of radiation have got to be considered as possible causes of cancer.
No question. But I think you're doing a great job out there, and keep it up. And by the way, website we can find you at and buy the book.
Well, buying the book, the best bet is Amazon. Please go to your bookstores and ask for it. It's been interestingly not easy to find it in most bookstores, but Amazon and Barnes & Noble websites have the book. And our websites are saferphonezone.com and ehtrust.org, environmentalhealthtrust.org. And I want to thank you again for your interest in this issue, and hopefully we can come up with some more constructive approaches. We've got on our website, you can click on free resources, and there are safety cards and doctor's pamphlets that you can download. And we're looking for partners in our business campaign for safer phones. Any business that wants to commit to give away 100 copies of our materials a month can join the business campaign for safer cell phones, because we want to work with businesses, small and large, to promote the idea that distance is your friend and that cell phones need to be used responsibly. You know, cell phones are more like cars and trucks and guns than they are like tobacco, because they do save lives and they can be very important for our success in the world. So we need to use them in a smarter or safer way so that they don't damage us and our families.
Let me give you, before we go, we are really running out of time here, but let me give you an idea with your advertising for this, because you mentioned early on that, you know, you didn't want to, you know, frighten everybody. I'm using different words. But in its own way, they've got to be able to recognize it personally. Have you seen, and I'm not trying to be a smart guy, but I want to get the point across. Have you seen those Viagra-type commercials? The very end of them, it says, if it lasts for 4 hours, you know, call your doctor.
Yeah.
That of itself sold millions and millions and millions and tens of millions of dollars of the product. So when you're dealing with, yes, that was what sold it. That's all. Now, well, I know. Now, the point of contention is this. It's when you've got save the males, okay? What's going on with your sperm count? Breast cancer is that linked too. So you see, mm-hmm. those kind of headlines are what's going to cause somebody to look at the rest of what you have to offer. Otherwise, it's, same old stuff again.
Well, I appreciate that, because tomorrow morning I'm going to be on Fox News in D.C., and I will tell them that save the males ought to be what we should focus on. Because,
Absolutely.
In fact, you're right. Men who use cell phones heavily have half the sperm count of others, and that fact needs to be much more broadly appreciated.
Yes, and I wonder how many eyes and ears just went up when you said that. That's your key.
Well, good. They can look for more information on our website, and I really appreciate the advice.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. The book is The Power of Internal Franchise, How Your Business Will Prosper When Your Employees Act Like Owners. Our guest, Martin O'Neill, and he's also the author of Building Business Value. Marty spent much of the last 25 years operating companies, consulting with senior executives, and writing and researching topics of leadership and of culture. And as a business operator, he's led startups, guided takeovers, steered turnarounds, and managed in private and public corporations. And as a consultant, he's worked with CEOs and leadership teams with goals of building long-term business value. He's currently a principal with Corsum Consulting. He's a frequent speaker and a consultant on leadership, corporate culture, strategic planning, and building enterprise value, and is the co-author of Act Like an Owner, and the author of Building Business Value, holds a number of board-level positions, and sits in the Business Advisory Board for the University of Maryland and Baltimore County Tech Center. Marty, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, thanks for inviting me.
Hello, Marty. We got you?
Yeah. We there?
No, Marty.
Are we there?
Oh, there you go. Can you hear me?
Yeah, are we there now?
Oh, yeah, we're absolutely there. By the way, did you hear the intro?
I did hear the intro, yes.
I was going to say.
And I'm frightened that I'm glad I'm landline, because I'm frightened after I listened to Dr. Davis. So I'm glad we switched over to landline.
Good. Okay. Very good. By the way, I think one of the most important and potent things can learn today, the businesses can learn today, is in your tagline. How your business will prosper when your employees act like owners. They do not have to have equity positions. But Marty, if they don't feel vested in that business, that really affects the bottom line, doesn't it?
Well, you know, if they don't feel like they have some opportunity and the tools to do what they do best every day, and if there's a lot of feely-touchy stuff on the employee side. And one of the things, Michael, that we came up with when we did the research for the cultural part of this book was that when employees felt like they had the opportunities, when they felt like their fellow employees were committed to the quality and success of the organization, when they felt like their opinions counted and they could share opinions, and that they thought the company might act on those opinions, when they felt there was a sense of connection between what they did every day and the performance of the company, it's only then that the environment was the place where you really wanted to be. It was only then that productivity went up. And oddly enough, it was only then that there was a correlation between actually profitability and workplace culture. So you hit it right on the head. It's if you can find the right environment, what we call the soil or the culture, then you've hit something on something really smart.
And I think the real difference today, more than anything else, Marty, is if you go back, you know, there was competition, and then, you know, somebody would create some kind of a product, somebody would come in lower, and so on and so forth. And in today's world, I mean, you know, it's a saturated marketplace today. And I think one of the most important things that a business can learn today is don't look to grow outside. Look to grow within. You take care of your employees today. You vest them in the outcome of your business. But you also do the same thing with your customers. And you build that customer base, and you make that customer base strong. And that's where you build from. When everybody's out there competing against each other and losing business, you get smart and you use what you got.
You use what you have. And one of the tricky things that companies have to get through is sort of define what they have. I do a lot of work, Michael, with companies in what we call the middle market. These companies that they're not startups, but they're sort of between, you know, revenues of $10 million and $150 million. They're established companies. And where they struggle with growth, where they struggle with sort of creating that next generation of leaders, is they have a hard time sort of defining what they do, because many times that magic sauce is kept in the leaders and the founders and the people that have been around for a long time. So when they're able to sort of be explicit and be purposeful on defining just how they do business and begin to teach that, and that's when this whole idea of an internal franchise takes place, where you can be really clear on what you do. And then you basically franchise that out, and you know, you think about it. If you're what America is really comfortable with this idea of entrepreneurship, right? And one of the fun exercises I do in any public workshop that I give, I split the room in half. And I make one side of the room say, and they're unbeknownst to each other, each side of the room, I say one side says, what are the attributes of your most valued employee? And the other half of the room says, what are the attributes of an entrepreneur? And I'm going to tell you, the lists are always the same, with the exception of risk, because people normally associate the entrepreneurial activity with some risky behavior. We end up talking around managed risk and things like that. But the list is always the same. So the attributes you want and your most valued employees, the people you really love, it's the they get the job done, they understand what the customer wants, they're meaningful in the kinds of things they do. They think about, you know, how to save the company money just because it's the right thing to do. They sort of go the extra mile. All those are entrepreneurial attributes. Those are the same sort of attributes we want in our workforce. So creating this, you know, this ownership culture, this culture of entrepreneurialism is key to creating that, what we call the line of sight, Michael, the line of sight between what people do every day and the performance of the company. You know, if you're really clicked in on the things that you do every day, that has an impact on the company, then you're more excited about it. A friend of mine used to be the president of Nabisco, and we used to joke. One night we got talking about why he always had a hard time recruiting really super technical people. And he said, we'd lose them all to Microsoft or somebody else. And I said, you got to think about it. Nobody wants to work for a consumer package company in IT because that's a very difficult line of sight. They want to be in sales organizations when they work with consumer packaging companies. IT people really want to work with technology companies. So it's more difficult for those companies to make that link. But if you can draw that line of sight between what folks do every day and the performance of the company, then you begin to sort of encourage those entrepreneurial attributes that we just talked about.
And a prime example of that would be somebody, let's say, and you own a business and you have an accounting department and you are looking for a way to increase that bottom line. You do what all the businesses do. You're sitting in a situation now where you're budget crunch. You got to do more with less time. The economy's slumping. You know, consumers are spending less. So you've got to create that synergy that you're talking about. And let's say you're in the, I'm working for you. I'm in the accounting department and I sit there and I look at it and I say, what can I do to save the company money? So I start to research on my own now. I start to research. I start to take a look at different ways to be able to go through the processes to come up with a more rapid, less expensive way to do it. So let's say I've really got this done. I come to you. I say, Marty, take a look at this. I found a way to save the company $10,000 a month. Now, $10,000 a month is $12,000 a year. Now, how much do you have to do to spend to get a net of 12 grand? And if you've got everybody in different departments doing that, my goodness, look what happens.
Right. You know, that's a great story. And the more of those, what we can do is encourage companies to try to find that folklore within their companies. I always tell the story of the clown rate. One day in a previous company, our CFO, our financial officer, came in and said, you know, one of the guys in the accounting department was just joking that we paid the clown for the summer picnic more than we paid was more than our average billing rate. And we were in more of a technology consulting firm. And a lot of highly educated master's degrees in technology, the technology field. And our billing rate was one of the key management indicators that we used to run our company. Well, the CFO came in and said, you know, we paid the clown this year $75 an hour, and our average billing rate was only $72 an hour. So from then on, what we realized, we had a bit of a blip in our operating model. In other words, we empowered our project leaders to negotiate and to change pricing when the project was established. But we never realized that we didn't teach them that when they gave away margin too quickly, that would come back to bite us. So we had our CFO come to the next all-hands meeting. We were a very open, sort of transparent company. We had our CFO come, and we dressed him up like Bozo the Clown. He had the orange hair and the big nose and the ears and the big floppy shoes. And the mantra was that, you know, you never want to bid a project less than the clown rate. And I'm telling you, Michael, we dropped a whole bunch of money to the bottom line in about two quarters just because our project leaders never wanted to be caught dead charging anything less than the clown rate. So the point I'm making is when you communicate to the staff, when you communicate to your team on the metrics that you want to drive, you have to put it in sort of Main Street terminology. Sometimes organizations get a little bit too caught up in fancy terms like return on invested capital or something like that. And the staff has a hard time translating in that to what can I do to improve that? Well, if you know that you don't want to bid less to bid any jobs less than the clown rate, and you saw the CFO dressed up like Bozo the Clown, you'd remember that. So it's
sure.
important to make it sort of Main Street terminology as well.
One of the things I remember years ago, probably 25 years ago now, 20 years ago, and I spent a lot of time in the interior of Alaska in Fairbanks, and there was I was doing consulting at the time. There was a dental office that I was working in as a consultant and not as an employee there. And I remember coming in one day, and I talked to the dentist, and I said, okay, I've got an idea. Just let me have a free rein here. So he said, okay. So the very next staff meeting, I got up and I said, everybody in this room, you've just seen the last raise you'll ever get. The eyes got open, the mouths dropped, you know, everybody was in, what's going on here? And I said, what we're going to do now is we're going to pay a commission. Anything in excess of what the average income has been for the last 6 months, everybody will split the commission. Now, what you do is you go out and you get people to come into the dental office. And everybody was out there from the different departments, et cetera. They were bringing people in. They increased, they made money, and everybody was happy. They made more money than they could have by getting an hourly raise at the end of the day. So in essence, it's getting people vested into it. Now all of a sudden they've got an interest in what's coming in that door.
Yeah, there's been a lot of really great work done over the last couple of years on the work, just the whole concept of work. Daniel Pink and Malcolm Gladwell, two really great authors, have done a lot of work in this. And some of the things that you should think about when you sort of assign work to people, that it needs to have a couple attributes in order to get people excited about things. For example, one, it needs to be autonomous. And what you're saying is that, you know, you showed initiative in your job, but you also felt some level of autonomy that you could sort of take control of the situation. And the work also has some complexity to it.
Yeah.
It just can't be sort of the same thing over and over again. And then it needs to be meaningful. It needs to sort of say, I can contribute to the corporate bottom line, or I'm saving the planet, or I'm doing something positive for my community or society. So it needs to have some sort of meaningfulness to it. And if it has those components, then you have a chance for getting people excited about it. But back to your point, Michael, on the initiative that you showed. Well, when in the book Power of the Internal Franchise, we say that's one of the signs of growth for an ownership culture. And you can sort of rate the company on whether it has a culture of ownership based on whether there's any initiative going on. And I take companies through these exercises let's rate the initiative in your organization. And then the next thing we rate is accountability. Is there accountability in your organization? In other words, your idea was really good, but then does it ever get implemented? And is somebody accountable for making it happen? And is somebody accountable for the results, positive or negative, on wherever they may be? And then there needs to be sort of this esprit de corps, this team spirit that exists in an organization, because, you know, you can't make that one change happen by yourself. There needs to be people to buy into that. And then finally, the last sign of growth for a culture of ownership is that there's focused on the customer. There's always sort of looking outward, looking at what the customers want, what the customers need, how can we better serve a customer, so they're all sort of aligned in the direction of serving a customer. So initiative, accountability, this esprit de corps, this team spirit, and the focus on the customer. And then if you have those attributes, then when you come up with the great ideas like you just had, then they can be implemented and they can be they can serve the customer better, eventually will serve the company better, and it's a win-win for the enterprise and the customer base. So what you did was fabulous, and I'm hoping that the leadership of that organization and the office there was very thrilled with your high level of initiative.
No, they were moved. And I was an outside consultant at the time. You know, when I was working with some different businesses, it's just having that little bit of a different idea. Look at the foundation of how and why you make your decisions. And usually it works out like this, why you're so critical in businesses today. Marty, you're going to see things that business doesn't see. As you look over their shoulder, you bring, quote unquote, the invisible up to the table. And once we begin to see what we didn't see, there's unbelievable unlimited opportunity within that, because there's nothing anybody has to look outside for. The problem is getting unburied what you already have to work with.
You know, and that's sometimes difficult for leaders to sort of get comfortable with. And And so what we have to do in our consulting practice, we have to find ways to collaborate among the senior leaders and the next generation leaders to make sure they're aligned. Because any change that an organization wants to make, if there's not alignment between what the top folks want to do and the next generation leaders and ultimately the workforce, it just doesn't get done. I use the analogy of these big, just imagine three rubber balls and they're tied up with another rubber band, and one rubber ball is sort of the mind of the organization, which represents the leadership and sort of the brains or the mind of the organization. And then the second ball is the body, which is the process and the structures, you know, how things have always been done around here, how things work. And then the third rubber ball is the soul, which I say the culture. So we have the mind, the body, the soul, the culture, or sort of the norms and behaviors of an organization. And we've all been in, you know, places where the culture is very timely. We get things done. We're meetings start on time. People take action items, and they're accountable for the results. But we've also been in just the opposite kinds of organizations where, you know, meetings never start on time. No one ever takes responsibility for what's been said or done. And as a result, you know, performance will always lag. So the idea behind this sort of change leadership idea is that these things need to move in unison. As difficult as that is, the mind, body, and soul, the cultural component, the structure and process of a company, and the leadership, they all sort of need to move in the same direction at the same time. Because, remember, we put a big rubber band around these things, and if one gets too far ahead of the other, if the leadership just says, this is a good idea, I'm going to run with it, but they don't make process and structure changes, or they don't make cultural adaptations, that eventually the inertia of the organization will bring it back. Same thing as if you just change structure, or if you just change process. If you don't change the cultural components or begin to move cultural components, that'll bring it back. So the mind, the body, and the soul all have to be moved along at the same time in order for change to really stick. And that's what we're talking about with the power of an internal franchise. It's really taking this franchise concept and making it a change, because most organizations find that, especially now, especially in this economy, that it's becoming too risky to try very crazy things. You know, you might want to acquire a company or start a new division, but this model is a very safe model, because it just says, take what you've done really well and be very explicit with that, and then instantiate that or replicate that throughout your organization, and it'll be managed by engaged entrepreneurial employees, hence the culture of ownership that we need to have, hence the attributes of the entrepreneur. But we need to be very clear on what our operating model is, and then we're going to kind of stamp that around. So it's and that's why this whole change management paradigm comes in so very important for a change to stick.
Marty, no question. We're running out of time now. Two things before we do this, and then I'm going to ask you for your website and where do we buy the book. Two things. One is everything you just said would work in a relationship, in a family. If they followed the rules, one wouldn't get ahead of the other, and you could have homeostasis, you could have balance. And the other one, if you send me another copy of the book, I'm sending my copy to the White House.
Okay.
Website we can find you at.
My website, the corporate website, is www.corsum.com. Corsum.com.
And can we buy the book there?
You can buy the books there. You can buy the books at Amazon or any of the online services as well.
Marty, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Michael, it's been a pleasure. Have a great evening.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
are so many simply incredible.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there.
Julie Orloff with us. She's the author of The Pathway to Love, Create Intimacy, and Transform Your Relationships Through Self-Discovery. She's devoted 24 years to helping people transform their lives through her work as a psychotherapist, executive coach, a trainer, a speaker, and a consultant. In addition to working with individuals, couples, groups, and organizations all over the world, she's written and published a variety of articles and appeared on radio and television programs. She holds a master's degree in organizational leadership from Chapman University, a master's degree in social work from the University of Southern California, and a bachelor's degree in psychology from the University of California, Los Angeles. And let us say, Julie, hi, welcome back. It has been so long since we've talked.
I know, Michael. It's so great to be here with you again.
Thank you so much for being here. It's been a good few years, and I think that's way too long. Let's talk about the pathway to love. Julie, how does someone recognize what love is?
Well, you know, there's different types of love, and I think that's what's important to understand. As a relationship grows and develops, the love evolves and deepens and shifts and changes shape and form as you move along. So while it may start out being a love that's filled with excitement and fantasy and anticipation and hormones, that isn't what you're going to have at the other end of a lifetime with someone. That's going to have a much deeper bond that's going to be based on a lot of history together and a lot of, I would say, kind of a direction that you want to go to as a couple. You know, the relationship kind of has its own life force at the end of the day.
So in essence, what you're really saying is you and I meet, we fall in love, but the love's going to be a certain definition. It's going to look a certain way. It's going to work its way out in a certain way. And as we grow together or apart, then that love is going to, it's going to grow also. It's a continuous growth to match up where you are in the relationship at the time.
Yeah, I mean, there really is a process to follow. You know, relationships grow just like anything else, just like a business grows, just like a tree grows. You know, it has a developmental path. And there are things to do along that path to deepen that relationship or to determine, like you say, if the relationship isn't a good fit for the two people.
Yeah, now, by the way, one of the things we do is, you know, you've done it, we've all done it, I've done it, everybody's done it. You spot that somebody across the room, and it's as romantic as you're ever going to get, and you get absolutely wild, and you unload yourself. That can be scary in today's world, and I think there's that line in the sand that's drawn to hold yourself back, and at the same time, if you don't let enough of yourself go, that other person is never going to know who you are.
Yeah, you know, phase one is really tricky in that way because, you know, we're filled with excitement and we're filled with hormones and we're filled with all the stuff that wants us to jump in really fast. And at the same time, all our anxieties or fears about being hurt or if there's we've had bad experiences in the past, they get activated as well that, you know, put up all those red flags. So, you know, I akin phase one to that double chocolate layered fudge cake phase. It's really good, but you have to be really careful because you can miss signs that you need to see during this phase, and you can also make up signs that don't exist. So we walk around a little bit unconsciously, and that's why it's you have to tread carefully through those waters, as wonderful as those waters feel.
Julie, one of the things I learned years ago, and I mentioned it a few times on the air, you and I meet, and we decide to get into a relationship, and everything is going great, okay? And 2 years go by, I walk in one day, and you say, I'm leaving. And I said, what do you mean you're leaving? You don't love me. All right, so let's go all the way back to the beginning. What if the way I've learned to receive love is a wink, a look, a tone of voice, expression, something? And you, just hypothetically, if I buy you something, that means I love you. Well, for the 2 years, I'm winking, I'm doing all the stuff that I know to do to show you that I love you, but I don't buy you things at those particular moments. So when you say, I'm leaving, you don't love me, I say, what do you mean I don't love you? Then you say, well, you don't show me. Now, I've showed you in every way I know how, except for the way you've learned to receive it. And I think that's one of the major mistakes in relationships today in the very beginning. If it looks like it's going to get a little bit serious, it's to sit down and to say, how do you receive love? And I think that shows total respect for the other person.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, that's the biggest component that gets missed is that communication. You know, to really understand what makes you feel loved and cared for and vice versa. Because once you do that, then you have something to work with. But I think you have to play it both ways. In other words, you have to be able to explain to someone what makes you feel loved, but at the same time, you also need to hear how they like to give love, because I think it's give and take. It's a bit of both. It's a balancing act.
Sure. No, absolutely. A relationship is not 50-50. A relationship is 100-100. And if you don't have 100-100, that's why you've got such great divorce rates today. What is it, 55, 60% first year? And that's because we don't know each other. Here, you and I meet, and I'm not going to be me. I'm going to be who I think you want me to be, because I don't want you to walk away. Well, 6-8 months go by, I get comfortable, and I start to creep out. Maybe you don't like what you see, and all of a sudden you're different. You're not the way you were in the beginning. It's so frightening for most people to just say, okay, I'm vulnerable. I'm quote-unquote emotionally naked. This is who I am, and that's it. And if you don't like it, then somebody else will.
Well, you know, that's crucial. You're kind of explaining that phase two, that when relationships move into that point where you can't only put on your good foot forward, so to speak, and you start to really learn who a person is. And then you have to deal with your disappointments about who you wanted them to be versus who they are. And at the same time, you have to really start to identify, you know, your expectations. I mean, how realistic were your expectations in regards to what one person can give you? And to take a good hard look at, you know, what is it that's most important to you? You know, what are those top two needs in terms of what you need from someone or qualities that you're looking for? And understand that there's, you know, no way can one person provide all of your needs and wants and every time that you need and want them. So part of the self-discovery process is understanding where those expectations come from, you know, where are your vulnerabilities, what wounds are you hoping that your mate will heal and fill up for you, and then working with who the human being really is, and then working to a place of accepting for that person for who he or she really is.
Now, by the way, an interesting story to segue into the next question I want to ask about knowing ourselves through the other person. My sister has lived with me for about going on 2 years now. And in that 2 years, we probably got into two arguments. And I remember, and I got to make up, I can't remember what the words were, but I'm gonna make up some words here. We got into it, and I looked at her, and I said, you loser. And she looked at me, and she said, you're helpless. And I walked away, and I started laughing. And I walked back over there, and I said, did you know what just happened? See, I called her what I thought I was, and she called me what she thought she was. And I really believe that everything that goes on in a relationship, it's called mirror, mirror on the wall. Check yourself out, because that's who you are on the other side.
You've nailed it, and that's really what the essence of the book is about. It's really understanding that relationships mirror what we need to see about ourselves, and we project so much onto the other person. Really, there's a lot of stress and strain that we put on relationships that we don't necessarily have to, but by their design, it just occurs. And that's the opportunity, so that when your button gets pushed and now you're reacting to something, that instead of immediately going to the default position, which is the other person is wrong, they've done wrong, they are wrong, whatever, it's something wrong over there, we can turn it around and say, okay, what is it that I need to learn and understand about myself? You know, what is this stirring up for me? And then when you become conscious of that, that creates the space for you to heal yourself, so to speak, so that you can then go back to your sister, your spouse, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, and you can say, you know, when this occurred, this is what it stirred up for me. In other words, it stirred up all my feelings of helplessness, and that's what got triggered, and that was my what my reaction was all about. And then you have the opportunity to really understand and learn about yourself and your the other person you're in a relationship with at a much deeper level. And that's what creates the opening for growth and transformation. You know, I, as a therapist for many, many, many years now, you know, I've learned really the most powerful tool, what really helps people heal, is for them to have someone who listens in a certain way, that listens with the intention to truly understand where they're coming from, who they are, see them for who they are, not make them wrong for who they are or how they feel, and give them the space of acceptance, because it's from that place that we now have options and free choice to make decisions and move in different directions and create different things for ourselves.
Three things. One is there's a transition from listening to hearing. Most people listen. Very few people take the time to hear, and I think that's what you're talking about. The other thing is the second argument I got into with my sister, one of the greatest lessons that I believe can ever be learned was learned there. I think it was over the, what was it? It was over the cable channel and how to get the cable channel on. And I walked out of the room, and she said something. I said something back. She said something to me. I said something back to her. And then I walked out of the room, and about 2-3 minutes later, I opened the door again. I knocked on the door, and I popped my head into her bedroom. I stuck my tongue out her, and she stuck her tongue out at me, and it was over. But the point was this. I walked away, and you know what I got out of that? And this is the hardest thing for people to get. Don't have the last word. I call you a name, you call me a name. I call you a name, you call me a name. I call you a name, you call me a name. And this goes on, and we're back at it. But if you call me a name and I don't respond, it gets over faster.
Well, you know, because what's happened is that you were stuck in the who's right, who's wrong.
Yeah.
So when you do that, you have to keep, you know, sparring back and forth until, quote, there's a winner. And as you know, whenever you're going about conflict that way, there's never going to be a winner. There's going to be two losers at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So I tell people, when you're feeling very reactive, you know, you've got a strong reaction, that is not the time to engage in a conversation, because it's just too easy to get pulled into the power struggle. So that is, I think you were very smart. You know, that's the time to take a step back and really be more self-reflective. You know, what was this all about for me? What do I need to understand about myself? And also then, you know, what, you know, how do I want to understand where my significant other is coming from? You know, because there's something to learn about each other and all that. And so I think it's very wise. Get yourself centered and come at it from a very different perspective. And, of course, when it's siblings, I think you guys settled it just perfectly as sister and brother. Something's never changed.
Yeah, it's going to happen. But what I did is I took a deep breath and I smiled. When I smiled, I had a little dopamine squirt, right? And
right.
All of a sudden, it's learning also how to control your brain chemistry and realize what makes you act that way. Because the moment you feel that you're being challenged or you're being challenged, threatened, or accused, you have an actual brain chemistry change. And a couple of deep breaths can change that very rapidly. And the only other thing I have to say about relationships, the one problem that I have, I can't get anybody who remembers who Doris Day was and even acts like her.
Well, I'm sure they're out there. You just have to keep looking. So, yes, wouldn't it be lovely if everyone could be our fantasy movie star?
See, and I come from the world where the cowboy at the end of the movie didn't kiss the girl, he kissed the horse. You know, this is a whole different world.
You know, it is. I mean, it is and it isn't. I mean, it's a whole different world because, you know, generations that are coming up are raised in a very self-gratification and a very little immediate gratification culture, and our technology has just exacerbated that. But you know what? Human beings are still human beings, and sure. I have two daughters that, you know, one's a young adult, one's almost an adult, and they still, bottom line, people still want to love, and they want to be loved, and they want to feel connection, and being vulnerable and intimate in this world is still a struggle just because we're human and we've been hurt and wounded, and we get hurt and wounded pretty early on in life, and it starts to then snowball on us, and it, you know, creates its own world for us. And that hasn't changed. It really hasn't. And that's why I really wanted to give people a process, a roadmap, you know, an understanding of the nature of relationships and really what they can offer in terms of your own healing and your own transformation, and that we really can create relationships in our lives that work. I do tell people, though, I can't promise it will always be with the person you want it to be with, because there are just some, you know, there are some relationships that have a life cycle, and at some point it's reached the end of it, and it no longer works for both people.
Well, Julie, okay, they always work. The key is to, and you said it early on, the key is to, when the conflict starts, understand what's underneath the conflict and learn from it. And if it's one of those kind of conflicts where you end up not being together, you both won if you learn something from it, because then you take it on to the next one and you get stronger.
Exactly. The problem occurs in relationships where you have one person who's willing and able to do that, and sometimes you have other people that are just still stuck. They're stuck in their own internal turmoil. And it's truly, truly difficult for them to get out of their way and be able to do that. And that's when it sometimes becomes like, you know, you're hitting your head against a wall over and over and over again. So, but everyone has the innate capacity to go there. It's just a matter of, you know, when people are ready, able, and willing to move into that way of relating. And it's imperative that we do. You know, our world, it depends on that. You know, it's not just a spouse to spouse, or friend to friend, or sister to brother. I mean, really, it's country to country. I mean, it's really imperative that everyone learn how to do that.
See, now you know the dynamic of how my mind works. I'm in this place and I see a woman I'm totally attracted to. What goes on in my mind? Doris Day, Lady Gaga. Doris Day, Lady Gaga.
Well, I think I've heard men caught in that trap before. You know, that's how, that's the challenge of integrating different needs. You know, but they can be done.
I like Doris. Julie, we're running out of time. Website we can find you at?
Website is www.julieorlov.com. That's JULIEORLOV as in victory.com. Or you can get to me through www.thepathwaytolove.com.
And by the way, and the best advice for your girls, the bar none, the absolute best advice for them is they're always going to be mama's little girls, and when they accept that, then everything will be fine, because then you'll be able to get along. When I was in my 40s, my mom was my mom, and I was always going to be her little boy, the youngest, and that's the way it was going to be. And the moment I let her be mother and I became the little boy, which I always will be, the relationship was wonderful.
Yeah, well, you know, parenthood never ends, so it just changes, but it never ends. So,
gotcha. Hey, we're looking forward to having you back on.
Thank you. Let's not make it 3 years this time.
I'm with you. Enjoy.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Sha da 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 dee 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 d
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. Ted McGrath with us. And to hear him tell it, inside each one of us is our own best self, just longing to express itself, ready to step into its game with passion and fulfill its true calling. Ted's a guy who walks the talk, whether Ted's sitting with you over coffee, coaching one-to-one, or addressing a room full of professionals looking to create more abundance in their lives. Sooner or later, he's going to toss out what becomes his signature question, who are you? Hey, Ted, welcome to the show.
It is a privilege to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, that's a very interesting question because I would venture to guess that most people would have no idea how to answer that question. The question could be answered, well, I'm the president of this. I'm the this of that. That's not who you are. That's what you do. And I think most people don't know the difference between the two.
I would fully agree. In fact, it's the first question that I got asked about 13 years ago when I was interviewed for a position. And the first question the guy asked me was, who are you?
Yeah. Got it loud and clear. And I'm sure that took you back and that started this journey.
It started the journey, absolutely. And I think you bring up a great point. Part of what I love expressing to people is that nobody's really interested per se so much in what it is that you do. I think people are more interested in why you're here, why you do what you do, and really who you are, because that's really what matters in today's world.
And take it the step beyond that. What is it that you can offer me? And you can't offer it to me unless you are who you are. It's like if you're married, you know, the question would be, did you marry your wife or did you marry how she made you feel? And there could be 10 women standing there and she's the one that's going to have that spark for you. So it's how she made you feel. And the only way that she could do that is because who she was is what you saw.
Absolutely. 100%. 100%. I think we tend to get away from that. We tend to get stuck in our roles of what saying what we do based on trying to impress people. But I think what's needed most today, and I think what really inspires people, is when people come from a place of, you know, what their core mission is, what their purpose is, and all of that really emanates from who we are. And I always like to boil it down to one word. If you were to answer the question or somebody were to ask you this question, who are you, boil it down to one word. And for me, it's always been the word inspire. I use the word inspirator. I look at myself as an entrepreneurial inspirator. And I feel like the word inspiration defines who I am. And you mentioned the word feeling. That's one of the most important things, because if you say my value is inspiration or my value is happiness or my value is love, well, that's great to have that as a value. But if you don't feel it every single day of your life, if you don't feel it and experience it, what's the point of having it?
Okay, so ask me who I am.
So who are you?
Funny you should ask that question. As you said, I'm a doorway.
I like that. I like going through doorways. Do you open up the doorway of light to everybody?
Absolutely. No, it's a doorway. The doorway is, if there are people who listen to what you have to say and gain the benefit from what you have to say, I'm the doorway to open it up to get them there to you. Not to do whatever it is to do, but if you're an inspirer, I'm a doorway.
I love it. I love it. That's fantastic.
I'm going to get a t-shirt.
Get a t-shirt that says doorway. I'll get one with inspiration, and together it'll be an inspired doorway, right?
There you go. Or the doorway to inspiration. You know, you go. But I really believe when you come down to it, most people don't know. And that's where the real problem is. And it's not what they don't know. It's what they don't know that they don't know. And sometimes it takes somebody looking over your shoulder to point out what you're not seeing. Because so many of us don't see that something about ourselves that is going to be the inspirer, the doorway, the whatever that it's going to be. And I think that's the key. You have so much experience in so many things, and there are times when you have to sit back and let somebody else look through, or you look through your life through their eyes.
Yeah, and I also think with what you're saying is, most people, I think, when they get stuck in the mind of trying to figure out what their purpose is here on this planet, they try and answer with the mind, and oftentimes the mind will second guess and it will give you a million different answers. But when you get into the heart and you clear out the fog, I like to say, and you get rid of all the fear and the doubt and the uncertainty that's fogging you from actually feeling into who you really are and why you're here, once you clear all of that away, I think there's a deep knowing inside each and every person. And I truly believe that every single person on the planet knows why they're here. But so many times it's caught up and it's distracted and it's covered up by this fear, this doubt, this uncertainty. So part of what I do is help people really clear out that uncertainty, transform that doubt, transform that fear, so that they get back in touch with their knowing, live their passion, and really go make a big difference in the world.
I'll bet any amount of money that if you went down any given street of any given city where the where there are stores, the brick-and-mortar buildings, et cetera, where they have products and services and goods to sell, if you knocked on the door and if the person who owned the business or the manager came to the door and you said, "Who are you?" they wouldn't know. And they sell products. They sell services. They sell causes. They sell, you hear it. They don't know. So we're dealing with an individual. A business is nothing more than that manifest of that of what that individual's consciousness is. Somebody had to create it. Somebody had to think about it before it actually became physical, from the unphysical to the physical. Now it's there. And, you know, who are you? And I wonder how many people can actually tell you that. And those that can are the ones making money.
Yeah, you're right. And it's also interesting to take a look at the fact that, you know, most people are so caught up in selling the products and the services, which today have become commodities. So when you really think about it, I mean, what do people really buy today? Most people are focused on, I got to get the better product, I got to get the better mousetrap. But when you really tune into it, the reason why somebody wants to have an ongoing relationship with me or why they want to have an ongoing relationship with you is not because of the products and services that you buy. It's because who you are. And it's
Let me take it a step further because I don't want to lose this point.
Sure.
I think it goes beyond who you are. It goes beyond what are you going to fix for them. What do you what about you represents a solution for them to a problem that they have? And if it's not knowing who they are, that's a problem. So it's not who you are. It's what you can do for them. People, and you know, this is a horrible thing to say, but it's true. I'm going to say we as a human race, we don't care about, you know, we don't care about you, don't care about me, don't care about anybody or even what you have to offer until they realize what you have to offer can benefit them. And if the benefit is how to truly live a life and be a human being, then that's what you've got to offer.
And I'm right in line with you because I always say to people, if you were to answer the question, what's fascinating about you? And then you were able to package what's fascinating about you and then put it into a process that clearly communicates and articulates to other people step by step exactly how you're going to help them get what they want, then you have a co-creative relationship where everybody wins, and that's how you're really serving people.
Oh, I totally and completely agree with that. And as a matter of fact, when we're dealing with this, more and more people who begin to know will become more and more successful. We have the quote-unquote the entrepreneur now. The entrepreneur are those people who there was outsourcing, they lost their job, they went home, they got their computer. Now they're level the playing field and they're competing with the big boys because they don't have any expenses. So if it's one or two people at home or it's a company with 10,000 employees, realistically what you're saying is at the base of everything that's going to cause a company to be successful.
Absolutely. And I come from both schools of that. I used to work in corporate America and run a large office with an insurance company there. And now I have an entrepreneurial company and I work with entrepreneurs all across the world. And you're right, it's exactly that. And I think today, even in today's economy where people are looking at the problems that are existing, I think there's no better time than right now for people having the opportunity to really reinvent themselves and to find the solution that's in this problem right now. And it exists out there, no question about it.
Sure. And by the way, you know, that word reinvent, it's an interesting word because I'm wondering if it's really reinvent or becoming who you really are. We really wear a lot of masks, those facades, and the reason we wear the mask is to be able to survive in the world that we happen to be in, and we push down that really who we are, where all of the abilities and the opportunities can be right there, and my goodness, what you can do. But I think when you become who you are and you let it all go and you get, I think I said this once before on the show sometime today with another subject, but when you become quote-unquote naked and vulnerable, that's when you're powerful, because then they can't hold anything against you to stop you.
Dead on. Dead on accurate.
Now, by the way, the businesses today, they've got to compete. What's the best way in this world to compete?
That's a great question, and I think that businesses today are competing too much, like I said, on products and services, where they're becoming commoditized. I really truly believe that the best way to compete is to go to where nobody else is. There's a great book out there called Blue Ocean Strategy that talks about how the majority of people are swimming in the red ocean where all the sharks are swimming and chewing one another up. If you really want to be successful, you go out into the blue ocean. You go out there to where nobody is. You create an uncontested market space out there, and you do something totally unique and totally different. And the way you do it is simple. You tune into who are you, what's fascinating about you, what's unique about you, and then you start packaging that into processes and models that you can deliver to customers, and you'll do it like nobody else because it's you. That's who you are.
By the way, it is a model, and I think because life, I think, well, I won't even say that. It is. Life in and of itself is a process, and a model is a process. You know, a chair is a process. You start out, you build the legs, you put the seat on, you put the back on, and if you don't have that process and believe in that process, then it really dilutes the end result of truly what you get. And I think that, that question of who are you, and if you were to ask it in every phase of a business, and it, even to the point of saying, you know, if you're a book, who are you? If you're a product, who are you? And if you get down to the essence of that, then nothing stops you because now you've got your competitive edge. You know what it is that you're selling.
Yeah, and at the same time, it's taking that, and you talk about process, and I use the word as well, it's taking who you are and that fascination factor and then giving people a step-by-step process to show them, because let's face it, I know what I do, you know what you do, but communicating that and then sharing a step-by-step process to where somebody's actually going to do business with you is a totally different story. So creating that step-by-step process where every step of the way you show them, step one is this. Here's the problem that most people are facing. Here's the solution that we're offering up. Here's how it's going to deliver value to you. And here's the tools we're going to use to get you there. And if you can walk people through, because the mind wants that, it wants to know step by step by step, if I'm going to work with you, how are you going to take me step by step by step to get my end result? And that's when people write big checks. That's when people sign on. That's when people want to do business with us.
Absolutely, and they have to see it through other things. I think we live in a world today when the old way of selling is pretty much gone. You know the get the hidden objection, the closing this, and the yada yada, and the reason for that is the internet. There is so much that you can have on the internet. There isn't anything I can't find today. I can sit right here, and I probably mentioned this two or three times in different areas, but I can sit right here if I want to buy a new car, click the buttons on the computer. I can shop the entire market in not only in the Milwaukee area, but probably in the next five states around me. I can get into the price. I can get into the car. I can go into the Carfax. I can negotiate with the salesperson, and it's all sitting right here and clicking. So we don't like to we don't like to be sold anymore. That those days are gone. But we love to buy, and it's in a way that you can frame it where they would want it, where they've made the decision and you haven't told them.
Yeah, and on that same note, people love to be inspired to take action. I believe that that's what sales is, that you inspire people to take action on the very thing that they want. And if you can help people get clear on their vision, on what it is that they want, because you know, that's one of the greatest questions in the world to unfold somebody's potential. What do you want? And so much of the time, people are focused on the negative things or the things that they don't want, and they're trying to push all these things away. But if you ask somebody a simple question of what they want, if you ask them a visionary question to help them look 1 year or even 3 years into the future, and then you help them see what it is that they want, and then you're the one who helps inspire them to take action, you know, that's the 21st century, quote-unquote, sales process, I believe. And I don't even believe in sales, so to speak. I believe in inspiring people.
Oh, I'm there. There you go. The inspirer is coming out, no matter what you do. let me ask you, if we're starting to run out of time, is there a website we can find you at?
Yes, there's a website that they can go to, which is Rize Global, R-I-Z-E, global.com. /BBI, like BBI, exclusive.
And then
in fact, they can go on there and get free tickets to our next workshop.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, that works. And do you do webinars and things of that nature?
We do webinars, but we have a big event coming up this weekend in San Diego, and they can get tickets there, riseglobal.com/BBI exclusive, and they can go there and get a free ticket.
I'm going to tell you something, but you got to promise not to tell anybody. This is our secret here, that I remember San Diego when it was a sleepy little community of 50,000.
Yeah,
Or was that my grandmother, my grandfather, my grandmother who remembered that?
Come on.
Hey, Ted McGrath, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
There isn't any more. We've shared a moment. And as the moment and I got a funny feeling we're parting now.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, friends. And that, my friends, is a wrap.
Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls.